I'm Christopher Lydon with Derek Bach, the only two-time president of Harvard University, which is to say he's reinvented the administration of the oldest, richest, maybe the best university in the country. First in 1971, in the middle of the Vietnam War turmoil and all that. And again, 35 years later, after Lawrence Summers left the job early in 2006. So you're qualified, Derek Bach, as the fixer of the university system, and you've written and studied it extensively. Fix it. First diagnose it, and then let's make it better.
Well, what's wrong is all in undergraduate education. I think our professional schools are, generally speaking, acknowledged to be the best in the world. I think the research in the United States is without equal in the world. But we do have problems at the undergraduate level, in part because our graduation rates are too low and have not been increasing for the last 30 years. And secondly, because there's increasing evidence that the quality of education is not as good as it ought to be.
Mm. Thinking back on your own 50-plus years experience, but also the century, where are we?
Well, I think we have progressed during the century in two very important respects. One is that we went from a situation in which even the best universities had very little research. It was only a marginal part of their activities, to a place where many people argue we almost have too much emphasis on research. The other thing that happened is that we moved from being a place where 5% of the population might have gone to college, or probably less than that, 3% in 1900. And now, of course, about 80% of high school graduates will at least start college. Not enough of them will graduate, but it's become, in other words, universal to at least go to college. But that's not true as you move down the income scale. We still find that some very talented students from low income and even middle income groups who have all the ability needed to go to college for one reason or another don't get there. There are a number of students who certainly have the ability to finish college who do not finish college because either they find they run out of money and don't want to get further in debt, or because somehow they just don't feel that the education they're getting, they don't see how it's going to be really useful to them, or because somehow they just don't get integrated into the life of the institution so that they develop ties that make them want to stay the full 4 years and complete their work.
Derek Bach, you haven't fingered the money dimension as a critical problem on the top of your list, but let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about student debt. Let's talk about huge inflation, administrative bloat, some people like to emphasize, but speak about it in general. The $1.2 trillion debt that students are carrying as they enter the workforce, as they enter the careers that are going to, we hope, regenerate the society and the economy and the culture. Isn't something fundamentally amiss on the money scale?
Oh, I'm sure there is. I think going to college and paying for college has become an increasing economic burden for all but the kind of upper middle class and the high income classes. Now, there are several reasons for that. I mean, one certainly may be that there are unnecessary expenses. I always had the feeling that I ought to be able to shave more money out of the budget, but when I tried to do so, I found it was very hard. In other words, there weren't sort of a lot of low-hanging fruit that you could get rid of. If there was bloat, it was so finely distributed throughout the system that it was a labor of Hercules to
But was that a problem, really, of politics and oxes being gored, or was it that you actually couldn't find fat that a rational person would have cut right out?
When I looked, I certainly didn't find a lot of easy cuts that one could make. And then there are other things that are very expensive, which like intercollegiate athletics, that probably a lot of university presidents would like to cut, but they can't face the enormous political and social pressure that would be brought against it. So they continue to spend millions of dollars just to finance the kind of football games you see on television. So, I mean, that's part of it. But there are some other subtle problems that we should bear in mind because they're a very large part of the problem. One problem is that for at least two-thirds of the population, their incomes have not grown to any significant extent for the last 30 years. Mm. And college tuitions have always risen a bit faster than the cost of living for reasons we could go into, but it goes back to at least to the time we started collecting statistics at the early part of the 20th century. And it didn't really matter, for example, after the World War II, for 30 years. It didn't matter before that because wages tended to go up. Incomes went up for everyone in the population. Mm-hmm. Those were years, after all, when blue-collar wages rose faster than CEOs of corporations. And so even though costs were going up a bit faster, they weren't going up faster than income, so that people were not having to pay a larger share of their disposable income to go to college. That hit a wall 30 years ago, and for two-thirds of the population, income ceased growing, which meant that as college costs continue to rise, it's beginning to take a larger and larger share out of the budget. And so that's part of the problem.
I mean, that sort of growth doesn't fit the context of the economy or people's lives anymore. I mean, something has to bend.
Yes. Something has to bend, and the question is what?
But 65K now, we're getting used to that number. This is a deep social and political as well as economic change. I mean, what we thought of forever as the great gateway incubator of the great American middle class is now this giant obstacle to a middle-class existence. That's a big deal.
Well, I think you have to... It depends very much on what institutions you're talking about. I mean...
But I'm still thinking the very big picture. If you landed from Mars and said, your young people are $1 trillion in debt. It's common to hear of averages around $30,000 up to $300,000 coming into the workforce, which is not robustly hungry for your services, and you're asking the next generation to carry these weights as they sprint, toward the future, you'd say there's something wildly wrong here, wouldn't you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you mentioned that figure, and it is kind of frightening, and I'm sure there are quite a number of students who are graduating from college who, I think the average debt is $29,000 for seniors leaving college. That doesn't disturb me very much because...
Well, the average is not so bad as the common experience of up to 100, say.
There are outliers, and I do think to some extent those are self-inflicted wounds. Wow. I mean, those are colleges where, given the financial aid and the tuition and the alternatives elsewhere, the students didn't really have to roll up debts of that kind. And those are the cases you read about in the newspaper, and they do give you the impression that students everywhere are laboring under these burdens. But as I say, the average debt is under $30,000. And one thing that is often not remarked on is that the economic bonus for completing college and having a BA degree has been going up too. So it's at historic highs now, so that the financial return for going to college has been going up at least as fast as the debt. So that in terms of are we consigning an entire class of people to a financial future which is unsustainable, the answer is clearly no.
Well, I wonder.
If you then say, aren't there people wandering around who've taken out too much debt, given and also majored in classics or something else where the immediate job prospects are not that great? Yes, those people do exist. But from a national standpoint, I think we have to we have to look at the whole, and that's not as serious as you might think. And I can see from your eyes that you are
I'm trying to dare to push back at you.
You are not wholly persuaded.
No, I think that misses a sea change. You and I came out of school moderately well educated without a dime of debt. We never even thought about it, and it didn't shape our decision about what we had to do. For example, run to Wall Street and cover our butt before we made a family. It seems to me that's taking a toll that has to be measured. It sounds, in certain ways, like a tax on the young, a steep tax on the young to enter the work world, to enter the productive world, enter the creative world.
Sure.
Enter the educated world. First, you've got to pay a huge sum of money. $1,000 a month is not uncommon for kids coming out of college. That's more than their car. That's more than their rent. And it just seems socially immensely unproductive to me. And serious. A serious burden on the whole society.
Well, I think it's a problem that could be resolved in other ways because you'd have to convince me to really make a difference in those figures. To get the average debt of college seniors from $30,000 down to $15,000, you'd have to tell me what kind of a sacrifice in terms of the long run are you going to make in the quality of the education these students receive.
And well, that's one thing.
We could talk about administrative bloat and a lot of other things, but I don't think you can make the kinds of cuts that would be necessary to bring that level down without doing some significant damage to, and that would be too bad in the long run, because as I say, in the long run, it's a good investment, and students aren't going to be cheated. There is a problem in the short run. Mm-hmm. It may affect their decision about where they want to work. There is a way around it, and it's the way in which most experts suggest America ought to move. It's the way in which countries like Australia have already moved, and that is to put in some kind of income contingent plan for how you pay off your debt. The basic idea was, in order to get an educational loan from the government, which is by far the leading source of loans, you have to enter a contingent repayment plan where you agree that you will never have to pay more than what they usually say is 10% of your income, or depends on actuarially where you want to put that, but certainly down around that level. You never have to pay more than that percentage, and you'll only have to pay it for a fixed number of years, and then you're discharged of all your obligations. And it gives people, like an insurance policy, it gives them assurance against the risk that something might happen to them, or for one reason or another they're not able to, or they really want to enter some occupation that doesn't pay very much. It gives them freedom to do so, and they don't have to sit there worrying, how in God's name am I going to pay my educational debts? And so I think that probably makes a good deal of sense to students.
I think it's a terrifically interesting idea, with a big incentive to live a life of voluntary poverty, to you know, farm your 5 acres and write songs.
Chris, I would have to say that I think the United States has done extremely well at providing counter incentives that make it desirable not to take that risk. There's no country in the Western world that provides as high a monetary incentive to entering a lucrative career as the United States. So I think it'll take a lot of income to contingent plans before we're going to discourage large percentages of Harvard students, say, from abandoning plans to go to Wall Street.
We've just stumbled on an amazing drilling down into the numbers on college costs and the payoff for education, and a tremendous variation in the ratios. I mean, there are some colleges and some kinds of colleges where the costs are high, but the rewards are huge. There are other public institutions where the costs are low and the payoffs are huge. But then there are the exceptions too, and lots of them, of relatively, well, the high-cost schools that have very low payoff, including art schools, including all kinds of schools, and then the low cost that have very low payoff too. I mean, I wonder if we even want to know, or kids entering college want to know, what is the real value of this education going to be? Not just be pacified with the notion that college, 4 years of college, a BA gets you $1 million additional income over a lifetime. That's very average and very, very abstract. But that College X has produced graduates over the last 30 years that make less than than what you're paying every year for the school. Say,
sure.
Do we want to go there?
Mm-hmm.
In sort of quantifying each school's value in salary terms down the road.
Well, I think you're making a very, very important point, because to me, looking over what has changed in higher education in the 50 years since I've been associated with it, I would say one of the most obvious changes is that higher education is talked about increasingly, in part by college officials themselves, but I think only in reaction to kind of the universal talk by political leaders, business leaders, everyone else. College is conceived of as an engine of growth for the economy, a means of wealth, of greater wealth for the students. In other words, the economic value of what colleges are doing has assumed an importance that it never had when I was young. And there was always a feeling that college did a number of things for you. It enabled you to live a fuller, more rewarding life, to enjoy reading and many other things much more. It trained you as a citizen, which, of course, was the most important reason for education going way back to the time of the Greeks, 2,500 years ago. It tended to make you even, although some people doubt this, a somewhat more moral person. All of these have great advantages to the society. And somehow all the other advantages have somehow shriveled away. And we talk incessantly about what is the financial payoff. And ironically, the people who have studied this and looked at what are the benefits of college beyond just what income you get, find that the sort of non-market values of college, if you tote them all up, are probably greater than the economic values. And what are those values? Well, you get sick less often. You die later. You're not unemployed nearly as often. And there are a great many values to yourself and to the society that we just kind of lose track of. They're a little hard to cost out. But also today, so much is conceived of, not just in higher education but elsewhere, in terms of what effect does it have on growth? What effect does it have on the gross domestic product? And Keynes predicted in the 1920s that by this time the society would be wealthy enough so that people would not think in economic terms, and that they would be freed by the rising tide of economic development would lift all boats, and people would have time to really think of the finer things on art and music and philosophy.
John Adams' dream. Right?
Nothing of the sort has happened. I mean, there's a greater fixation on the economic value and a greater concern about what we can't afford than there has ever been. And no one asks me, what is Harvard doing to train people to be citizens? That just doesn't seem to be relevant to anybody anymore.
Really? I mean,
I see practically nothing about the non-market benefits of higher education. And there's a memorable speech which I could duplicate for all the recent presidents that was made when some big education act was passed and Bill Clinton was president, and he gave a short talk as he signed the bill. And what he said, we measure our high schools by one standard. What do they contribute to economic competitiveness and to the economic well-being of the graduates? He couldn't have said it more clearly, and you know, one can say, oh, well, wasn't that a silly thing to say, but it represents a dominant point of view. If you look at the public pronouncements of every president going back, it's certainly into the latter part of the 20th century. And you know, that to me is a real loss. And somehow I think we educators have not done a very good job of reminding the public in vivid ways that there are multiple advantages to education, and income is certainly one of them, and what it does for the economy is certainly one of them. But there are others, and we shouldn't lose sight of them. And a lot of the talk about how to get at the problem you're talking about, how to get rid of unnecessary expenses, how to bring costs down, and all of that, is really stripping away a number of the things that colleges do that don't have some sort of immediate a payoff in terms of getting a job and contributing to economic competitiveness and to the gross national product.
It's fascinating that you quote Bill Clinton to such effect, and yet we all know in our private lives, in our hearts, in our daily walks, that of course education is about our imagination and our culture and our conversation. And meantime, Helen Vendler and lots of others are pushing back hard. I don't know if you saw her piece in Harvard Magazine, but not just the intangible value, the cultural value, the social value, the value to our reputation, to our creation of literature and music. And what's the way back to acting, not only on what we know, but what's the way back to acting in politics, in government, in spending, in taxing, on what we all deep down know is the truth?
I wish I believed that we really know that deep down. And certainly it would be the job, first of all, of political leaders to do that. It would be quite easy without denigrating the importance, the economic importance of a college degree, to speak of these other things and to hold a nobler vision up of what it means to democracy. And I mean, I wonder what Thomas Jefferson would think. The whole reason he founded the University of Virginia was because he thought it was so essential to a democratic country. But our leaders don't do that anymore. And fortunately, there are people like Helen who are very eloquent and who do speak out in behalf of these values, but they're speaking into a void. There isn't resonance out there in the society. That's a great pity. And I don't, there's a big movement in this country now to solve the problems you've been talking about by emphasizing competency-based learning. Competency-based learning says you should get academic credit toward graduation for skills that you've picked up in the workforce. And the whole discussion of this is in terms of the only thing that's worth anything is skills that have a market value. And so we can easily substitute for college something where you go in there and pass a bunch of tests, don't have to go to college at all because you've shown that you can handle a lathe or a scalpel or whatever other trade you're going in, and then you've picked it up in some other way. It kind of breaks your heart when you think how little this takes account of the reasons for education, which have been propounded for really hundreds and hundreds of years and have somehow gotten forgotten in this generation.
Derek Bok, you see it all the institutional riddles and promises. Give us a reform agenda.
I do think it's important that we try to keep alive in the United States the idea that anybody who works hard and has some talent can go as far as his aspirations lead him, and that means should have access to the education to which his talents should entitle him or her. The one thing we haven't talked about, but that is the problem of quality. I mean, there's a lot of talk around that America has the best universities in the world. If you really look at that carefully, you could say, well, America has 40 or 50 universities that are extremely well-ranked in the world. What are those rankings based on? They're based on research. They don't tell you anything about who has the best education in the world. We don't know that. We don't know how to measure that. So, but if you look not at the research reputations of our best colleges, but you look at what do we know about what students are learning, there are a lot of discouraging signs in the wind. Yeah. One particularly damaging study, which has not been refuted, is that if you look at how much time students spend studying, you find the remarkable statistic that since 1960, the hours per week that students devote to preparing for class has dropped by 40%. And if there's one thing we know about education is the more time you put into it, the more you get out of it. And yet, if you ask what has been the reaction of colleges to this, we've simply accommodated to it. Because of grade inflation, grades have gone up, although the student effort has been going down. And that is a serious educational failure. And the evidence that we have, and there isn't as much as I would hope, it's not as reliable as I hope, but the evidence we have about how much students actually learn in college, where you measure what they knew when they came in and what they know when they come out, it's kind of disturbing. They certainly, on the whole, make progress. I think they don't make as much progress as they think they do, the students. They tend to overestimate very substantially how much they've learned. I mean, I think the world is a more complicated place. You need to know more than you did in the past, not less. And yet, I have a feeling our students, many of our students, are learning less than students learned 30, 40 years ago. And we ought to start taking that very, very seriously.
Speak, as you've written, about the problem of mission creep.
Yes, mission creep is the name that's given to a process throughout higher education in which institutions try to measure their success by climbing up the received hierarchy from community college to comprehensive four-year institution to an institution that gives master's degrees, to an institution that then gets into PhDs and graduate training and becomes a great research university.
And to have a tall building. And
that's
then
right.
To get into the money game.
That's
as
right.
Cooper Union seems to have done, from a free art school of great fame and durability to something else.
Well, I think this is certainly one of the most regrettable tendencies in American higher education, and no question about it. It has resulted in a great deal of misdirected effort and probably unwise expenditure of money. It's hard to know exactly why it is as strong a tendency as it is. My own explanation is that education is inherently a vague and uncertain idea. It's very hard to know how much students are learning, how much you are progressing in the things that really matter. And so the human desire being what it is to demonstrate improvement and progress tends to overemphasize things that are tangible. And so, and you see this also in the accounts of presidents who resign. I've never read an account of a president who resigned when they wanted to say something nice, where they said the quality of education improved under his or her administration. It's always to talk about how much greater the endowment was, how many new programs were started, whether it moved up in the college rankings. So there's this effort to find tangible demonstrations of progress and success. And unfortunately, those just don't necessarily lead you in the direction of addressing the problems that most need to be addressed. And we pay a very real price for it. This is peculiarly American, though, don't you think? I don't mean that success has no motivating power in other cultures. It clearly does. But competition is, you imbibe that with your mother's milk in this country.
And rankings. And
it doesn't much matter what the rules are, how success is defined. Once you know the rules, you unleash this enormous energy to get across the finish line faster than the next guy. And so when you say, what do we really need? One thing we very much need is to make vivid and important, as they truly are, what institutions at different levels in this conventional hierarchy can really do and why it matters. And so that people could gain the same satisfaction by having a really distinguished community college that they do by having a first-rate liberal arts college like Williams and Amherst, or a great university like Stanford or Princeton. I think it's a hard job, but it's an accurate job. There is a great distinction to be had at these different levels. We just don't yet know how to communicate it.
Dirk Bach, thank you so much. I think you've given us, we owe you a huge consulting fee.
Which I will not look for in next in tomorrow's
mail.
We'll
just add it to the debt.
No, it's been fun. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk about these things.
Dirk Bach's book is titled Higher Education in America. He was the two-time president of Harvard University from 1971 well into the new century. This podcast was produced by Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and Mary McGrath. It's part of a series on higher education. Please look for others at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of our Open Source podcast project.